A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to the Football Writers Podcast. It's a self-isolation special featuring me, Mike Calvin, Seb Stafford-Bloor from Football 365, and Adrian Clark, the tactical analyst. We'll be holding the fort over the next few weeks. We'll dwell on the big issues and the little things that mean a lot. Speaking of which, High Quality United retained the Bhutan Super League title over the weekend. Tenzin Finlay headed the winner and went into the Erling Haaland meditation celebration. Absolute scenes. Nice reminder of what passes for normality in football, isn't it, Seb?
Yeah, thanks for coming to me with that one, Mike. It's great. It's tested my knowledge of the Bhutan Premier League, which I have to say, actually, it's got some of the finest crests you can ever see in world football. If you look at High Quality United, it's like this sort of abstract teenager's tattoo type affair. So that's recommended. But yeah, no, I read the Wikipedia page. That's what I'm bringing to this podcast.
That's good. Now, will you read the minds for me, Aid, of the players of a certain age who are playing down in Australia at the moment? What would you have done at about 33?
I would have absolutely hopped on a plane and gone to play in the A-League, I think. No, quite a few of the guys, recognisable names, are over there at the moment. Stephen Taylor and Gary Hoop are there. They're at Wellington Phoenix. Wes Houlihan, Joe Ledley. Just been in action, actually, today for Newcastle Jets. Craig Noon is at Melbourne City. So, yeah, no, it's a good place to go. And I have to say that watching a little bit recently, because it's the only football you can see on TV right now, it's the standard's OK. It's technically really good. Some nice football. And I did read an interview from Simon Cox, who recently left Southend to go there. And he said it's championship level without the heat. So he says, because it's so slow, because of the heat and humidity, it's more like a League One game to watch. But he feels technically it's Championship. So look, the A-League is decent, but how much longer will it be on for? I suspect they might pull it sooner rather than later.
Well, you look at it, you've got the Aussie rules has been closed down. The NRL, the big rugby league competition, has been closed down today. So, yeah, I think you're probably on the right lines there, Aid. If you look at the scene over the weekend, Adam Lafondre, as you said, Aid, was playing in the Sydney Derby, scored the opening goal, did this great sort of gesture to a non-existent crowd. That then basically bore out the fact that even when football gets back, it's very likely to be behind closed doors. Seb, what are the pros and cons of that, do you think?
It's really hard to discuss this in football terms at the moment because it just seems so inappropriate. But I suppose one of the arguments you could make is the pro is probably that it keeps people safe. Also that it creates some semblance of normality. The obvious con is how alien it all feels. Now, I watched a bit of you quite rightly, Mike. I mean, the NRL closed down this morning. The A-League had a meeting scheduled, I think, for later today to discuss their future. But I watched some of the NRL over the weekend and it's bizarre to hear the players calling out to each other. It's very strange to see that level of competition occurring within no atmosphere. So in the Premier League, you're thinking of, if you were, you know, covering it from a media perspective, then you're listening to players calling to one another, to the referees issuing instructions and to the managers howling from their technical areas. I think the great con is that it's diet sport, isn't it? It becomes sport for sport's sake. It becomes an exercise in fulfilling duties rather than entertainment and enjoyment. It's all speculation because this is uncharted territory. We don't know what this is going to be like. And there's a little bit of me which is actually fascinated by the idea of an empty stadium game, because we've seen this in the Champions League before, when I know it's never quite been empty because people always seem to find a way around this problem. But yeah, stadiums have been closed for other reasons, violence, hooliganism, racism. So we've sensed that a little bit. But I don't know. I mean, I'm very conflicted about it too, because I don't know enough about coronavirus to know what's right. I don't understand it well enough, and I don't have a detailed enough oversight of what would be the right thing to do. It's very, very strange.
It is. And as you say, you know, it is inappropriate to talk about it given the current social circumstances. I've covered a couple of behind closed doors games, and what struck me was you are able to hear everything that's going from the bench. As a player aide, did you ever take any notice of what was shouted at you from the bench?
Oh, goodness me. Well, I was a winger, and I used to much prefer it when I played on the opposite side to the technical area, because managers were compelled to talk me through the game when I was on the near side, and it used to drive me absolutely nuts. I hated it. But on the flip side, when you were playing well on the side of a manager, then I felt like they took more notice than if you were on the far side taking the ball past players. They could barely see it. So I was slightly conflicted. But no, it's not good for players. I think if anything comes out of this, it is how important fans are. And maybe, just maybe, football players have always appreciated supporters. But, you know, one of the things that hopefully good and positive that will come out of this is that we all appreciate the part that football fans and supporters have to play inside the stadium, because the sport without it isn't a patch on what we're used to, is it? It's more like watching a training session. So look, who knows? If it's a sacrifice we've got to make to get these leagues finished, I think we would all do it. I think that the players would do it, the clubs would do it. But personally, because of the financial hit it would provide clubs, and for the reasons that we've outlined, I think it has to be a last resort. I personally would rather wait until we're all in a position where we can be close to one another again and kick the football off once more with full stadiums. And can you imagine, boys, the excitement of football's return and the buzz inside the stadium that first time we return? I think that's what we've got to cling on to, how good it's going to be when normality finally resumes.
What strikes me, Seb, is the role that fans want to play in all this. I was contacted yesterday by the Millwall Supporters Association. They're talking to other fan groups about a basic idea of delivering basic packs of food and other essentials to NHS staff at hospitals. So the idea is there's a concerted campaign by football supporters to actually be a force for social good. Is that the sort of thing you're hearing and you think could work?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, because I think it's a really influential demographic. And I think one of the roles supporters and supporters groups can play is to lead by example, essentially. I mean, it's a wonderful initiative by Millwall. I mean, I've heard similar instances around the country of Manchester City and Manchester United fans joining together to stock food banks. Something similar happening in Liverpool. But I think it's good because it represents the idea that people understand the seriousness of this situation, and that we've had problems around the country with people ignoring advice about gathering in big groups. And if football fans en masse can sort of lead the way and say, look, this is something we need to combat together, and we're prepared to kind of put down tribal rivalries to fight it, then that's a tremendous example. It's a great asset to this issue.
Yeah. Well, I had similar experiences talking to Phil Wallace, the Stevenage owner. Can you explain some of that?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Fantastic initiative from Phil Wallace. Look, I played for Stevenage. Phil Wallace was the chairman back then as well. He's a good man. And basically he said, look, we're not a football club. For here and now, we are not a football club. We are a community project. And he basically is using all of his existing staff, including the players, by the way, or those that are able to be involved. And he has set up different facets within the ground. But one is a chat line for anyone elderly, lonely, that's self-isolating, that they can just pick up the phone and call this line and have conversations and just talk, which we know is so, so important for mental health. They are gathering as much food as they can to take to food banks and storing it there. And then they're also going to deliver packages to the most vulnerable in the community. And I think some of the players are going to be involved in that. And I think they're going to be cooking up some food as well for the elderly. So I think it's brilliant. On the outside of the ground as well, it's really symbolic, actually. On the board that says the next fixture, it says Stevenage versus the coronavirus. And I think, you know, that's what they're trying to do. It's brilliant. And I would imagine a lot of football clubs will follow suit. But yeah, bravo to Phil Wallace, to Stevenage for setting this up. It's brilliant.
I suppose this all opposes the question, Seb, that whether football can be more than the game. You know, we are talking about social action. We've seen the initiatives that Chelsea have made. There's a fantastic, I thought, piece of empathetic leadership by Gareth Southgate. Wilf Sahar is doing stuff. You know, Gary Neville has opened up his hotel for NHS staff. Wolves have donated 1,000 masks and 1,300 protective suits. That is a huge social movement waiting to be put into action, isn't it?
It is. I sometimes feel like there is a great deal of benevolence in the game. Obviously not quite on this scale because these are exceptional circumstances. But I think by removing the headline portion of the sport, by taking the action away, it's provided a focus on some of these people and some of these groups. And it also might help to dispel some of the assumptions and prejudices that people harbour towards football fans. It shows the game at its best. And I think that's a really important thing. Obviously, it's taken something absolutely horrendous to provoke that. But it's very heartening to see. If I can just add Stephen Naismith's work to your list there, Mike, because he's another player that's been willing to challenge this head on. And although it's sort of he doesn't want the publicity, seemingly Andrew Robertson's doing an awful lot of good as well. So it shows the game's best face. And sometimes I'm frustrated at sort of the lack of opportunities the sport has to do that. And so if there is a positive to take from it, then absolutely it's this.
Yeah. And you do see players stepping up, as you just said there, Seb. Odion Ighalo has been a feel-good story anyway at Manchester United. It's great to see a fan playing for a club and, you know, obviously fulfilling a childhood dream there. I thought what he said about his contract rundown as being insensitive in the current times was very important. And we're almost seeing a new form of hero evolve here, aren't we?
Well, I think footballers have always had a conscience. Out in the community, it doesn't get publicised much, but the vast majority of players are more than happy to get out there and do the bits and bobs for the local foundations, the club foundations, the charities and whatnot. It's just difficult to find the time. Now, obviously, footballers have time to sit there and reflect and think about how to help. And it's brilliant to see it. As for Ighalo on the contract issue, absolutely. I mean, goodness me. Surely football can find a way to prioritise. And I would imagine those players out of contract on June the 30th, there'll be a unilateral decision, I would imagine, just to extend it until the end of the season as we know it. It's quite simple. You can even have an open-ended date on it if we don't know that. Just put to the end of the 2019-20 season. I don't think this is the time for players to be bailing out and moving on. And I don't think that they will.
Yeah, probably this one is for you primarily, Aid. There's a lot of talk about players having to take pay cuts because of this. What is your view of that? And, you know, when you look at, say, a lower league pro, 80% of his income would be around about that £2,500 mark, wouldn't it? They've got mortgages to pay and they've got worries financially, haven't they?
Yeah, look, I've been there in League One and League Two. And yes, absolutely. I mean, not everybody. Some people will be over it. But those that are over it will be in a more comfortable situation, won't they, financially? It's a difficult one. It really is. I do hope that clubs take up the government on that and claim the 80% of wages for players, because why wouldn't they? Why shouldn't they? Should it fall on the responsibility for the players to help out everybody else? Not necessarily, I don't think. We haven't heard a lot from the FA, haven't heard a lot from the PFA, the Premier League. I guess they're banging their heads together. At least I hope they are, in terms of looking at their own cash reserves and resources and thinking, how can we put this to use to save football clubs lower down the pyramid. And that includes going into the National League and beyond as well, because they have players to pay. I'm conflicted on it, because you know that Premier League players agreed to take a 25% reduction in their salary to set up a fund. You know that instantly it would provide the support that football needs further down the pyramid. And with all of us, we're all taking a hit on our money, aren't we, at the moment, especially those of us that work in this industry. You know, why can't footballers do that? It'd be a great gesture. Maybe it would be something we see in a few weeks' time, because it would be life-saving. But I don't necessarily think it should all fall onto the players. There's plenty of money flying around the game, and not a lot of it at the moment is heading towards those smaller clubs. Hopefully that situation alters in the days to come.
Mm. Interesting, Seb, listening to Rick Parry, the new EFL chief, where he's basically saying the Football League shouldn't go cap in hand to the Premier League and ask for financial support from those who can afford to provide it. Now, I thought that was, you know, rather submissive. I don't know what you felt about it.
I felt a bit uneasy, actually, Mike. I mean, I'm not... it's not very difficult to do the maths, is it? If you look down, right down to the bottom of the pyramid, League Two, also given what's happened to Bury and, you know, what's been happening to Macclesfield up until this point, it worries me, this weird amount of pride in Rick Parry's statement. It strikes me as being indicative of a lack of pragmatism, almost. I don't really understand what the solution is for clubs that are reliant on matchday revenue. I don't know whether the Football League is really taking the long-term future of its clubs seriously enough. Can I also just add something on the question you asked, Adrian? Maybe now is a really good time for someone like Gordon Taylor to lead by example, with his enormous salary.
That'll be a first.
Yeah, but this is, I'm not joking. I think I agree with Adrian completely. The burden does not fall on players to perform a sort of their own ad hoc bailout, but it would be a nice gesture. I think it would be a nice end of his tenure for Gordon Taylor to actually say, right, well, maybe this is a point for me to intervene, and this is a nice way to correct certain parts of my legacy given what I earn out of football. I think that would be most appropriate.
Well, certainly the PFA don't seem to have been proactive. Let's put it as charitably as that.
Yeah.
I would have expected them to be a much more upfront with this. I struggle sometimes to work out what the PFA actually does. You know, they're very self. There's a lot of self-aggrandizement, but I can't see exactly what they do. Now, you'll be able to tell me, Aid.
Yeah, well, they'll say, Mike, and they, to a lot of degrees they do. They will say they're there to protect the interests of the players. Now, in their heads right now, protecting the wages of the players might be at the forefront of their minds. Should it be? No, it really shouldn't. Not the Premier League players, not those that are earning an absolute fortune. I absolutely agree with Seb, and I think that's a really clever shout. It needs Gordon Taylor to go to the players, to go to those earning, let's say, over 50,000 a week or 20. I don't know what the cutoff is. I mean, anyone earning over 10 grand a week will be able to sacrifice something, I'm sure. Most people are down on their money at the moment, and I don't think it would be terribly received by the players. I genuinely don't. I really don't, given the climate around the country. If Gordon Taylor took the ball by the horns and went to the Premier League players earning X amount or above and said, look, I think we should donate 20%. Or 25% of our money to a fund that will be set up to save football beneath us in the pyramid. Absolutely. It wouldn't really hurt or damage those players, and it would create a much more positive legacy for the PFA and for Taylor.
Yeah. Do you think, Seb, there is a danger of us losing some of those smaller community-focused clubs?
I think it's absolutely inevitable. Last week, I did a piece on Bar City, who've just had planning permission for a local redevelopment rejected by the local council. And I spoke to a member of staff there, and it was outlined to me just how severe this challenge is without match day revenue and without that flow of income. I don't see a way around it, Mike. Without the work of local fundraising, without local charity, and I mean charity in the inverted commas sense, without that, or without a benefactor there to underwrite costs and losses and debts, I don't know what the alternative is. I haven't yet really heard of a proper plan to safeguard these clubs' future. And these aren't necessarily just, you know, football league clubs. These are local community clubs, you know, places in, you know, the National League, the Southern League, even below that. And where is the contingency to look after the sport? Because it is the sport. The sport does not begin and end with the Premier League or even the top six clubs in the country. It extends all the way down throughout the country to grassroots. And it feels to me like there aren't enough people in this country who take that seriously enough. It angers me because it's so negligent. I'm not sure what community is without care and consideration for those things. And so I'm really waiting for somebody to put their head above the pulpit and answer that question, really.
Alexander Seferin has been talking about this being a reset of world football. If you look at the Euros, for instance, you know, as it's set up, a tournament staged in 12 cities, that could well be impractical even when we begin again, couldn't it, Aid?
It could be, but hopefully we'll be away and in the clear, hopefully. And none of us know that, do we? And if we are, actually, I think in a way, having the 12 cities would be even more fitting than it would have been before. Because I thought it was a slightly nonsensical idea initially, but actually spreading the love around Europe at a time when we all need to come together again post-coronavirus might just be a great way of doing it. But look, who knows? None of us know how we're going to be in a year's time, do we? Yeah, look, there's a lot of water to go under the bridge between now and then. But look, I go back to the point, just imagine how good it's going to be. That is, in this period of such negativity, how exciting is it going to be to have the Euros, the Women's Euros, the Olympics potentially all in the same summer of 2021? That'd be a great way to bounce back, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, I think you're probably right. The Olympics, I think, will be probably put back to 2021. If you look at the practicalities of a restart, there is some talk already. China are about 8 weeks ahead of us in the whole COVID-19 cycle. And there's some talk of whether clubs could end up playing there. So, for instance, there's already talk in the South China Morning Post of the Milan Derby being restaged at the Bird's Nest in Beijing.
No, no.
What do you think, chaps? Premier League in China?
No, because I tell you what, I hope this is taken in the way that I mean it. That would set a very dangerous precedent. There could potentially be an argument to say that hosting a football match of that caliber is beneficial to a region and helps the recovery. And I'm all for that. But if you think that isn't going to be manipulated later in the future for some kind of 39th game nightmare by somebody, because this is already happening in the world, you know, already games are being hijacked and taken to other countries to make money. That is the essence of the sport. You cannot allow that. And I think it is highly manipulative, the idea of, right, well, we're gonna put it on here because we can make money out of this now. Very soon, that is a very, very slippery slope. And it's one which scares me.
Yeah, and you've got to retain the integrity of the league. We're saying we need to indefinitely prolong the end of the season so that it finishes for reasons of fairness. And we know that it will be impacted. Other factors will come into play that are slightly unfair, i.e. returning players, etc. from injury. But you can't go losing home games to go over and play in China. It would make an absolute nonsense of the league. So no, it's a non-starter for me.
Yeah. A lot of clubs are postponing training sessions. You know, some were meant to be during today, others tomorrow, and they're basically saying, stay at home, chaps. In your experience, Adrian, now you played at every level from the Premier League down to the Conference South. How easy is it to lose your edge if you don't have that regular match practice and match fitness?
Well, every player is different, first and foremost. There were some players that I played with that could do nothing for a month, 6 weeks, and come back and they'd be fit as a fiddle and absolutely flying. And then there'd be others, and I was probably one of them, that it would take, you know, a number of training sessions to get ready for a game and then a number of games to get properly sharp again. But the bottom line right now, Mike, is none of that really matters. I don't really care about players losing their edge, particularly. It's one of those situations whereby we have to get on with it. So when the world is ready for football to resume, I don't think football players and managers will need more than 2 or 3 weeks notice to get sharp, to get ready, just to have a mini pre-season, to have practice games on the training ground. No friendlies. We can't have public friendlies. We haven't got the time. That's all they'll need, 2 or 3 weeks. And look, if they're not quite right, so be it. We kind of have to crack on and get on with it. Everybody will be in the same boat, at least. So that's my view on it. It's not easy for players. There might be a greater risk of injury. There might be. But in the grand scheme of things of life and where we stand right now, I don't even think that is of paramount importance.
Yeah, understood that, mate. I suppose if we can't look forward with any degree of certainty, we can look back, Seb. Brian Clough would have been 85 on Saturday. Mm. I was watching, Believe in Miracles last evening, just for about the umpteenth time, just to give you, a fantastic insight into what he did with that club. Now, my memories of him were my first ever away trip as a very, very young sports writer was with Forest in the second year they won the European Cup into East Berlin, and they played Dynamo Berlin. And Cluffy was just a force of nature. His relationship with Peter Taylor is still intriguing. What's your take on that?
I think it's a tragedy because Clough and Taylor is such an unusual partnership in the game because it doesn't really exist now. Didn't really exist in the same way in terms of not really two equal partners, because Clough was always the charisma and he was always the dynamism and he was always the one on doing punditry on TV and in the papers. But it was just, it seemed like such a perfect marriage in terms of what their attributes together allowed them to do. And I, for those who don't know, obviously the real fracture in the partnership was when Peter Taylor wrote With Clough by Taylor, which is his autobiography, which is a very, very strange dynamic for anybody's autobiography to be written about somebody else, essentially. It's a terrific book, but it's still slightly bizarre, and Clough never forgave him. The real tragedy, of course, would be that Peter Taylor passed before they could ever repair their relationship. And that's kind of, in anything written about that partnership, that's really paragraph 2 or 3 now, sadly. It's this situation where you can't talk about them without this dreadful ellipsis at the end of it. And it's a shame also because I don't think Peter Taylor is remembered as he should be, as a mind, as someone that spotted players. I mean, there are so many stories. The one that I always come back to is the Gary Birtles one where, Clough organised a training match for Taylor to have a look at Birtles. And he was absolutely rubbish in the game, but he produced one little moment, a little drag back, a little piece of skill. I was actually going to try and ask Gary Birtles this once in a press room at Molyneux, but he shamed me for not having a dessert. But Taylor had that sort of that elusive thing that we're still celebrating in Scouts Today, covered in your book actually, Mike, where it's almost like a supernatural quality. Look at a player, see him for a couple of minutes, yes, he's got it. And Taylor had that. And as a result of the fracture in his relationship with Clough, and he's kind of been carved out of that story in a way. And that's a terrible, terrible shame. I think it's, forget the football aspect of it. As a human tragedy, they were great friends. They were confidants for a long time. Taylor was crucial when Clough lost his playing career through injury. And it's terribly sad.
Do you think that a player responds to a distinctive type of management? And has that process changed over the years? I thought it was really interesting. John McDermott is going to the FA as assistant technical director from Spurs. I think it's a brilliant appointment, very empathetic management. He did a wonderful thing with Japhet Tanganga, where he just sensed that the lad was losing a bit of focus when he was in his later stages of his scholarship. And he sent him to work with the ground staff for 2 weeks just so that he appreciated that some people work a lot harder for their living than he did. Has the nature of management changed fundamentally?
Well, I think that aspect of management has existed since we began, and it will continue to play a major part. It's knowing the right buttons to press, isn't it, at the right times. It's knowing each individual pretty much inside out and being aware of that. And Brian Clough was brilliant at it, a great motivator, great man manager, and knew exactly when to, you know, poke the bear and when to stand back and treat the players to something unexpectedly nice at times. It's just keeping them motivated, getting them to think about where they are at that moment in time. And that's great to hear in regards to McDermott and Tanganga. It's smart. And he's not the only guy that will have done that down the years. And I think footballers like him will probably look back on their careers in you know, 10, 20 years' time and say, you know what, that was a big moment for me. Thank you. I'm so glad that he thought outside the box, because I didn't need that at the time. I did need reminding that you need to work hard for a living, that there is life outside football, of what I might have to do if I don't make the grade. So yeah, but people like John McDermott are absolutely invaluable to the education of younger players in particular. And that it sounds like a great appointment. Look, he was in charge of that academy for a long, long time and did a lot of positive work. Pastoral care of players in particular, I know was a big thing. So look, yeah, the FA have got a good man there by the sound of it.
Staying on Spurs, another one for you, Seb. Daniel Levy told fans that, and I quote, "He doesn't believe there's a direct correlation between winning and spending money. It's all about making the right decisions." Discuss.
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, he's right in the kind of disingenuous, hugely reductive way. Yes, that's true. But you need the caveat in here is, yes, you do need to spend money, but you need to spend it in the right ways. I mean, the other side of that argument is having money is no guarantee of success, and I completely agree with that. I think you're quoting that from the Tottenham Supporters Trust.
Very good organization, by the way.
Yeah, terrific. The work of Martin and Kat is brilliant, and they get an awful lot of grief online, which they absolutely don't deserve. They're brilliant. They're a huge benefit to the club. What concerns me is that there's no real recognition within that of Tottenham being where they are almost solely because of the work done by Maurizio Pochettino. Now, time will tell whether I'm right or wrong about this, but I would urge Daniel Levy not to conflate making what was kind of a happy accident of an appointment that turned out far better than anyone could ever have imagined with actually making a series of very good decisions within the football department of a club. I think those two are very different things. And one, it shouldn't instruct what happens going forward. The need for money is one of the great primacies of modern football. There's no getting away from it, whether we like or not. That's just the reality. You do need to have money. You do need to be able to spend a lot on transfers and pay huge amounts in wages. There is a balance, absolutely, but let's not get carried away. You can't do modern football in a successful way on a budget. Just can't happen.
Yeah, Mr. Levy is a hero to some, a villain to many. On that theme, you know, we're all searching for our football fix in as any way we can. I rewatched the Maradona movie at the weekend, and that prompted a whole sort of flood of memories, you know, personal ones. You know, I was at the Hand of God goal in 86 and saw him, you know, drugged up in the US World Cup and basically out of control as Argentina manager in South Africa in 2010. You know, that's an extraordinary life. And I try to bring it back down to him as a footballer. And, you know, to me, he's almost the football Nureyev. If you see him with a ball at his feet, it just basically obeys his command and is sinuous in his running. He's got huge strength, but great delicacy, as though that feels a bit strange to say. To me, he's still quite probably the greatest ever player. What do you think, Aid?
Well, I don't want to sit here and say he's not the greatest, because my personal view is that it's Lionel Messi, but I know that he hasn't carried Argentina to World Cup triumph, and he, you know, in the eyes of a lot of people, that's something he needs to do. So I don't want to detract from Maradona, but Maradona was a genius, and everything that you say is absolutely bang on. The ball was his friend, and I had the pleasure of watching him back in the day as a kid. And in the flesh, actually, at a centenary game, I think it was the Football League centenary match at Wembley, he played. And I was just so excited as I think I was about 10, to Maradona's. It's amazing. You could just see he was a class apart even then. But yeah, watching the documentary the other night was an absolute treat, wasn't it? What a player. And he produced all that brilliance under such intense pressure and scrutiny. And I think that is because carrying the hopes of Naples, you know, on your shoulders pretty much single-handedly is not, I would imagine that's one of the hardest things you could ever do as a professional footballer. And he did it. And he did it with style and swagger and by being himself, didn't he? Yeah, what a player. He's villainous in many ways, if we're going down that route, in terms of his personality. He's a flawed character. You know, I've met him before, and he wasn't particularly nice, let me tell you. He really wasn't. He messed us around. He was quite rude and abrupt. And, yeah, not obliging in the way that Pele was. You know, I was lucky enough to meet him. So he's not necessarily a great fella, but as a footballer, Just pure genius. We saw that on the documentary.
I remember talking to Pele about Maradona, and he came up with a fantastic phrase, which was, the angel walks with the devil. Do you get that, Seb?
Yeah. I just wanted to ask about, you were filing copy from the Hand of God game. Did you get the handball in what you phoned in, or did you have to have it correct it later?
It was one of those, it was a bit like a sort of depth charge. We worked it out about 5 minutes later. We were on running copy, and at the time it looked weird. It was to the goal to our left, and you know, I don't know what you feel. I do the same thing when I see penalties awarded. You actually judge what's gone on by the reaction of the players.
Yeah,
and the players basically, you know, they weren't having any price around them, and so you knew something had gone on, but weren't quite sure immediately. So for practical purposes of doing the piece, you know, we got around it quite quickly. But what used to happen in those days was basically the press box became a self-help group. Everyone asked one another, did you see it, what do you think? So we basically went with the majority. It was a really weird game, because the angel and the devil, well, okay, you can say that the handball was the devil, but the other goal was the greatest goal I've ever seen scored. And it was one of those ones where you just exclaim, you know, I won't use the words I used on this podcast, but it was a wow, gosh, golly, you know, it was unbelievable. And I suppose, you know, when we all sit back and think about football, a moment like that, or moments like that, capture what football's all about, and probably why we miss it so much, to be honest. So if we take that as a point, I'll be interested in your view, Seb, about Maradona and, you know, the whole greatest ever debate.
Oh, it's hard, because my personal rule about this is I try and only judge players that I've seen in person. The only Maradona I ever saw was the 1994 ephedrine version, which wasn't flattering as a portrait. I also, it's hard as well, because I think... seeing players on television versus the experience of seeing them live, seeing them as actual athletes, as physical specimens with all their technique, their ability, their vision. It's just such a different experience. Cristiano Ronaldo is still the best player I've ever seen live, I think. I haven't had the pleasure of Messi, unfortunately. But I think what I'd say is that sort of the mark of a really great player is as an opposition fan, if you're afraid every time they touch the ball, if you sink back into your seat, if you're afraid, no matter where they pick up possession, no matter where they are, and no matter how many defenders are covering them, if all your muscles contract and you push your way back into your seat, that's the mark of greatness. Like it's a level of respect, which is really, really rare in the game, really elusive. Messi obviously has that. Ronaldo definitely had it. Thierry Henry had it, which is very hard for me to say given my loyalties, but yeah, terrified you. And I'm sure Maradona, I mean, I've seen all the footage and I've watched as much of Maradona as probably anyone, but it just never live. So it's really, really hard to have any sort of opinion about him.
Right. So in the interest of normality, chaps, I know this is wildly inappropriate, but I wouldn't mind a couple of bits of transfer gossip. Adrian, what about Arsenal and Partey from Atletico Madrid?
Yes, I think that's a transfer I certainly would like to see happen. I think that when we do resume, and once the season's done and dusted, when Mikel Arteta is allowed to rebuild his team, his squad, someone stylistically similar to Thomas Partey, and maybe him, would be ideal. Yeah, I think he was brilliant against Liverpool, across both legs, looked after the ball very smartly, very sensibly, good athleticism. I think that's a key trait that's maybe missing at the moment from the Arsenal engine room. And I also love the way he drives forward with the ball at his feet. He's not afraid, is he, Thomas Partey, to travel with it. And who does that remind you of? Is someone I had the privilege to play in his first ever game wearing the red and white of Arsenal. It was a reserve game against Bournemouth. And that's Patrick Vieira, someone that can take the ball past players from that deep midfield position to open up the pitch himself. And Partey has that. So, yeah, look, for me, look, you know, I'm not privy to their scouting mechanisms, unfortunately. But if I was, and if they were to ask me what's the type of player that we should have moving forwards, I think that Partey would tick an awful lot of boxes. So, yeah, hopefully Arsenal will be in the box seat to get him. I know that Atletico at the moment are maybe trying to get him to sign a new deal that will increase his release clause, which at the moment, I believe, is under 50 million, which would make him a bargain. So yeah, watch this space. But stylistically, he's bang right for Arsenal.
Jadon Sancho, Seb, linked quite heavily to Chelsea. Where would you think that he would be best served by going?
He's best served by staying exactly where he is, Mike. It's one of my great bugbears that the young players have to be in such a rush now. He's found a situation which has helped him to grow exponentially in a very, very short space of time. He's surrounded by this young clutch of players, including Erling Haaland, of course, Giovanni Reyna, Dortmund's 17-year-old, the son of Claudio. And I'd love to, from a selfish fan's point of view, I'd love to see 2 or 3 years of that trio growing together. At the same time, I fear that, you know, money will talk, and that there's been a sort of a disintegration in his relationship with Borussia Dortmund following events of late last year, with him returning late from international duty and being subbed early against Bayern Munich. I don't think those wounds have healed. But he's just playing such excellent football that I don't want to see him defaulted into a Manchester United or a Chelsea just because he is the must-have item in English football. Can we trust those clubs really to adapt what they are around him? Because he's a special player and he deserves it. I mean, Dortmund have got the very most out of him. And why, if he spent 3 or 4 years still at the Westfalenstadion, would he not have the best chance of reaching the apex of his potential? And that's what we should want. We should want to see players getting everything they have out of themselves. And there's nothing yet in this relationship with Dortmund to suggest that he can't do that where he is. And it would just be a tremendous shame.
That said, he'd be great at Arsenal. He'd look lovely in red and white.
Can't afford him, Adrian. You cannot afford him.
No, I know.
Because it's always interesting also that Dortmund are still probably number one on the list to try and get Jude Bellingham.
Yeah.
And again, were I in Bellingham's position, or his father's position, who's having quite an influence on his career, you'd look at going to Germany and a couple of years there, that would be the perfect transition into whatever we want to call it, superstardom or whatever. The flip side of that aid is when you become an established brand in football tends to take second place. No prizes for guessing. I'm talking about Paul Pogba. You know, we've seen him wearing a Juventus kit. Now, was that a wardrobe malfunction, or was this another pointed message that I'm going to leave Manchester United?
Yeah, well, it's just ill-advised. It's not clever. We're just counting down, aren't we, the days, I think, for Manchester United to sell Paul Pogba. There's not much more to be said. I think he's a supremely gifted player, really talented. I personally love watching him play when he's on fire, Paul Pogba. Manchester United are a better team, and he's a joy to watch. But is he worth the baggage? Not now that they've got Bruno Fernandes. They've got a new main man, haven't they, Manchester United? Fernandes is the player they're going to build around creatively moving forward. So they just need to sell him. And look, if Pogba wants to go to Juve and Juve want him and they stump up the money, that will happen. I just hope that the exit can be done as tastefully as possible.
Fine. Well, this is a time above all for perspective. Thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast. We'll be back soon. And please, stay safe out there.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has two limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code MOM.